star cruising altitude, it's time for the Flyover View.
Welcome back to Flyover View, a member of the Heartland Pod family, a podcast, and a look at Heartland news from 30,000 feet. From the Gateway Arch to the Rocky Mountains, I'm your host, Kevin Smith, and I want to thank you for joining me today as we dive into the stories most impactful to you. Folks, let's begin today's show. And Biden got Mexico to pay for it. Mexico on Tuesday agreed to contribute $1.5 billion to a joint initiative with the United States to improve infrastructure along the United States-Mexico border. The agreement comes on the same day President Joe Biden hosted his Mexican counterpart Andrés Manuel López Obrador for a meeting in the Oval Office. Part of their discussions were expected to include a commitment from the two countries to carry out a multi-year joint U.S.-Mexico border infrastructure modernization effort for projects along the 2,000-mile border. The infrastructure project is intended to improve processing and security along the border. Biden alluded to Mexico's investment in remarks alongside López Obrador before the meeting, saying, "We're also making historic investments in infrastructure modernization across our 2,000-mile border with Mexico." He noted the $1.2 trillion infrastructure law he championed last year was delivering $3.4 billion to major construction projects at ports of entry between our two countries to make our border safer and more efficient for people, trade, and commerce. "And the American people should know, Mr. President," Biden told López Obrador, "that you're also making a significant investment on your side of the border to improve infrastructure to meet the needs of our times and the future." The collaboration signifies something of a reset between Mexico and the United States as Biden tries to distance himself from the Trump administration's contentious relationship with Mexico. In 2019, then-President Donald Trump threatened to impose tariffs on Mexican imports until Mexico substantially stops the illegal flow of aliens coming through its territory. When Trump launched his presidential campaign in 2015, he promised, "I will build a great, great wall on our southern border, and I will have Mexico pay for that wall." It was a promise he repeated time and time again throughout his run and his presidency, ultimately building more than 450 miles of new wall with money that had originally been allocated for the Pentagon. But the project ended when Trump was voted out of office, and Mexico never paid for any of it. When asked to comment on the commitment, a White House official said core to the prior administration's immigration strategy was to build a wall, and they couldn't even accomplish that in 4 years, let alone get Mexico to pay for it. By contrast, President Biden is taking unprecedented action to secure the border. An update on our ongoing coverage of the Agape boarding school abuse scandal. Agape Boarding School, which has been under scrutiny for nearly 2 years over abuse allegations, lists several organizations on its website that it says accredits the Southwest Missouri school. But now, some of those groups say that is no longer the case. Spencer Toter, a United States Senate candidate who has been pushing to close the school, said two organizations have now revoked Agape's accreditation, and another group that recognized the accreditation has now removed it. The Association of Christian Teachers and Schools notified Toter of its action Monday night. Agape Boarding School is no longer accredited with ACTS, according to Steve Lindquist, Director of Accreditation and Member Services, in an email sent to Spencer Toter. Another organization, the National Council for Private School Accreditation, which had recognized the ACTS accreditation, has now removed Agape from its website. And Accreditation International said in a post this month on its Facebook page that it had withdrawn Agape's accreditation many years ago. The actions come amid increasing pressure from Toter, a Democrat from St. Louis, and Robert Buckland, who along with many other former Agape students has been calling for the school to be closed. Toter states, "And now we have had three of the organizations disown them. We're calling them out, and we're not going to stop until we have accountability and we shut Agape down." Toter is a realtor and entrepreneur seeking the Senate seat being vacated by retiring Republican Senator Roy Blunt, and he says the accreditation groups are all intertwined. "It's very clear that they don't actually underwrite these organizations," he said. "They just allow people to do whatever the hell they want in the name of religion." Prompted by stories of abuse at several unlicensed boarding schools in Missouri, the General Assembly passed a measure last year that for the first time gave the state oversight over these facilities. Authorities also launched an investigation into abuse allegations at Agape, and in September, five staffers were charged with assaulting students. Representative Carrie Engel, a Democrat from Lee's Summit, was the first to call for a legislative hearing and co-sponsored the bill. She's communicated with many former Agape students since late 2020. She says, "I'm happy to hear that Agape lost its accreditation. Giving a seal of approval to a facility under serious investigation for child abuse makes no sense." Agape also faces 19 civil lawsuits filed in the last 16 months by former students alleging physical and sexual abuse. Buckland, who attended Agape from 2007 to 2012 and filed a lawsuit against the school last August, said he was pleased at the news but frustrated that it's taken so long. As a victim of child sexual and physical abuse in Missouri, it's disheartening to see victims fighting harder than politicians. I have begged Governor Mike Parson and Attorney General Eric Schmidt's office over 100 times each to close Agape and prevent more victims. Toter said after being contacted by Buckland and researching the lawsuits and felony abuse charges against Agape staffers, he contacted three of the organizations listed on Agape's website as those that have accredited the school. The Association of Christian Teachers and Schools is a nonprofit organization that strives to set new standards of Christ-centered academic excellence while assisting Christian schools to realize the highest level of educational credibility. Toter emailed Axe on June 19th saying that, "In my communication with the people across the state, I've become aware of multiple occasions of sexual abuse that have been verifiably accounted for at Agape Boarding School." On their website, Agape Boarding School had touted the Axe accreditation, and I would like to know if you've been made aware of this situation and if you have plans to pull their accreditation, given multiple accounts of rape and abuse. There are pending cases against this school, and there's no reason to doubt the survivors. Toter included a story from The Star about the lawsuits filed against Agape that alleged abuse and a tweet from Buckland that showed a video of a student allegedly being kicked by a staff member. He followed that email up on June 22nd, and another on June 27th. And in that one, he included a link to a recent segment on The Banfield Show on News Nation that featured interviews with Buckland and the mother of a student who is suing the school, alleging her son was abused there. Still receiving no response, he sent yet another email that Saturday. Toter finally received a response on Monday night saying that Axe no longer was accrediting Agape. Taking a step back from this story, we should realize that as laudable as these accomplishments by Buckland and Toter are, they shouldn't have to be working this hard. They hit the nail on the head when they rightly criticized individuals like AG Eric Schmidt, notably also a candidate for Roy Blunt's seat. He has all the power needed to shut this place down, but he does nothing. In Schmidt's case, he seems to be more concerned with TV ads for his campaign where he hits dingers with a baseball bat, yet ironically whiffs on doing some actual good for this state. Even one of Toter's primary challengers, Trudy Bush Valentine, recognized in a tweet the good work that Spencer had done in this arena. Toter's response? Thanks for the endorsement. Houston helps the homeless. During the last decade, Houston, the nation's fourth most populous city, has moved more than 25,000 homeless people directly into apartments and houses. The overwhelming majority of them have remained housed after 2 years. The number of people deemed homeless in the Houston region has been cut by 63% since 2011, according to the latest numbers from local officials. Houston has gotten this far by teaming with county agencies and persuading scores of local service providers, corporations, and charitable nonprofits, organizations that often bicker and compete with one another, to row in unison. Together, they've gone all in on Housing First, a practice supported by decades of research that moves the most vulnerable people straight from the streets into apartments, not into shelters, and without first requiring them to wean themselves off drugs or complete 12-step programs or find God or find a job. There are addiction recovery and religious conversion programs that succeed in getting people off the street, but Housing First involves a different logic. When you're drowning, it doesn't help if your rescuer insists you learn to swim before returning you to shore. You can address your issues once you're on land, or not. Either way, you can join the wider population of people battling demons behind closed doors. Before I leave office, I want Houston to be the first big city to end chronic homelessness, says Mayor Sylvester Turner. In late January, Mr. Turner, who is serving his final term, joined Harris County leaders in unveiling a $100 million plan that would use a mix of federal, state, county, and city funds to cut local homeless count in half again by 2025. Half a century ago, America invented modern homelessness. The stage was set with the shuttering of psychiatric hospitals in the wake of abuse scandals and the introduction of new psychotropic medications. The cities started offering tax incentives to owners of flop houses or single-room occupancy hotels to convert their properties into market-rate rentals, condos, and co-ops. In New York City alone, more than 100,000 SRO units that had housed substance abusers, elderly singles, former inmates, and the mentally ill were lost. During the 1980s, back-to-back recessions combined with the Reagan administration's severe federal cutbacks targeting low-income housing and poverty assistance programs forced more and more Americans including large numbers of families, into homelessness. On top of all that, Reagan-era tax reforms encouraged the construction of high-end single-family homes, but not affordable multifamily rentals. A decade ago, Houston was one of the highest per capita homeless counts in the country. Its homeless response system was in shambles. The city was squandering millions of public dollars and police officers' time by jailing homeless Houstonians for intoxication. Residents living on the streets, under bridges, and along the bayous were using ambulances to get basic medical care because they had no other way to do so. What started to bring about change was the passage in 2009 of the Hearth Act, which stipulated that in order to receive federal dollars, cities had to adopt a housing-first policy, and, crucially, that homeless organizations had to work together in continuums of care under a single lead agency, coordinating their programs and sharing data. Federal government had recommended these continuums of care since 1994, but not until the Hearth Act was funding tied to specific metrics of effectiveness. With the new regulations set to take effect in 2012, the Obama administration's Department of Housing and Urban Development offered money and expertise to 10 cities where homelessness was a particular problem. Houston was among them. Anise Parker was Houston's mayor at the time. Ms. Parker is the opposite of a slick politician. Blunt, wonky, unassuming, a software analyst of the oil and gas industry for 20 years. She became city controller, managing Houston's money, before being elected America's first openly lesbian big city mayor in 2009. The White House offered an expert on homeless aid, Mandy Chapman Semple, to help Ms. Parker herd the cats. They invited dozens of the city's homeless service providers to a meeting. The continuum was given a name, The Way Home, and the nonprofit Coalition for Homeless of Houston-Harris County was appointed its lead agency. Some food banks and religious and other service providers that made prayer or sobriety conditions for housing did not join. But more than 100 local and regional organizations eventually signed on. Houston started collecting real-time data, as opposed to relying solely on a once-a-year census. At first, the goal was to house 100 homeless veterans in 100 days, and after that was achieved, 300 more in another 100 days. Then we thought, if we can do that, we can do something really big, says Ms. Parker. Ms. Parker says, the homeless guy on your doorstep who spits on you when you leave your house and is always spouting from Revelations may be the least sympathetic character in the world, so you may not like the idea of paying to house him. But you can't complain about him being on the street and also complain about him getting off of it. Homelessness is a calamity millions reckon with each day, a calamity provoked by a mix of rage, fear, and powerlessness in the housed and unhoused alike. The big reveal seems to be not that Houston had solved the problem. It hasn't. There is no one-time fix to homelessness. The reveal is something different. It's that in broken America, it's still possible for adversaries to share facts and come together around something contentious and difficult. Public and private, county and city, business and nonprofits, conservatives and liberals, the housed and unhoused. In Houston, enough of them have agreed on a goal that seems worth striving for. Working in concert, they have made genuine progress in housing previously unhoused people. And, so far, the benefits of collaboration have fended off the usual forces of entropy. And that's an eye-opener and a sign of hope. Hey there, folks. Before we hit the break, I want to inform you that we're taking a brief layover with candidate John Carlin. John is a Democratic candidate for Missouri's 3rd Congressional District. John, I want to welcome you to the Flyover View today and just kind of ask you right off the bat, how you doing?
Hey, Kevin. Thanks for having me. I'm doing great. We're down to under 3 weeks before primary day, so it's obviously very, very busy, but it's an exciting time.
Is that all the further we are?
Yep. August 2nd was 3 weeks from this past Tuesday. So we're down to like 18 days.
So by now I've seen you at 4 separate events, including our own Heartland Pod Live event. And that means that I've seen you as many times as I've seen Spencer Toter, for example. And we all know that that guy has hustle. So So in a state where running for office is never easy, what made you decide to run for office in the third?
So first of all, I mean, when you talk about a guy like Spencer or any of our great Democratic Senate candidates, I know how hard it's been for me to run in a 14-county district. I don't know how any of these Senate candidates do the statewide race with 114 counties. So hats off to all of them. We've got some great people running to fill that seat and hopefully get a Democrat in there after, you know, a lot of years of wasting that seat for Missouri. As far as what made me decide to run, reaching a breaking point of everything that the Republicans have been doing. I've been politically active since I was a kid. And I reached a point where I decided that the best use of my time was to actually seek office. It was right around a year ago. We were just coming out of COVID, and Missouri Republicans were being particularly intransigent about doing the things that we needed to push ourselves forward. The Texas Republicans were doing the early drafts of their heinous abortion bill, and these are issues that mean a lot to me, along with many others. And I just reached a point where I said I couldn't just be screaming into the void online anymore. I had to put my name on a ballot and get my voice heard. And the past 10 months of doing that have been amazing.
Well, I know we have a difficult time in Missouri finding people to run for office, but what about your background makes you confident that you can represent Missouri's third? And what do you bring to the table for your constituency?
So I've had a pretty successful career in the private sector. I've worked since the mid-90s in software development. So I've seen a lot in terms of the evolution of businesses and the economy. And I've developed strong problem-solving skills from having done that. In addition to my experience as a professional, I have dedicated a lot of time over the past 15 years or so to just understanding policy. I've been politically engaged. I've studied issues, and I've studied the process, which, as we learn more and more, is as big of an issue as who you have there is how to work the process. So I bring a lot of knowledge and also just deep passion for the issues that I stand for, and think I'm ready to make a big difference.
Well, and on your website, you say that you represent a new leadership delivering results for your district. What do those words mean to you and should mean to your potential voters?
So our district has been represented by Blaine Lukemeyer for 6 terms, so 12 years. The state of Missouri has had a Republican supermajority now for over 2 decades. And so to me, a new leadership is both in terms of changing the party that's making the decisions and representing our voice in Washington, also just replacing a slate of incumbents that have grown increasingly stale, that do increasingly little, that just stand in the way of progress. And just yesterday, the incumbent that I'm hoping to run against if I get through the primary in a couple weeks voted against an Amber Alert type system to notify the public when there's an active shooter situation, because they're so afraid of casting gun ownership in a negative light. They just stand for nothing. They do nothing. And I have a complete agenda of things that I want to do for the people of Missouri. And it's not just the social issues of promoting a pro-choice agenda, standing up to this horrific Supreme Court decision that came down a few weeks ago, and standing up to Republicans in Missouri who are trying to capitalize on making that decision as harmful as possible to as many people as possible. But it goes beyond that. I want to deliver broadband to some of our more rural communities in the state, of which we have many, and of which my district has many.
Well, and I know that I sat in a meeting with the Warren County Democrats and listened to you talk about broadband and how that's kind of more of a meat and potatoes issue that I really like that you're bringing to the table. And I mean, there are these overarching issues of pro-choice and gun rights and things like that. But hearing you talk about something like broadband access it's really endearing to me.
But people need those things, because as passionate as we get about the social issues, and I those are the ones that keep me up at night. People sitting at their kitchen tables need to pay the bills. And the broadband issue in particular is one that strikes home for me. I've been in software development and internet related activities since 1995, when it was really in its infancy. I've seen the economic opportunities that it can create. And over the past 2.5 years, as we've seen the COVID epidemic, we've learned how many jobs really can be done from pretty much anywhere, with the caveat if you have the physical access to technology that enables you to do that job. And as we drive around some of the areas of our district, I've spent in nights in Marist County and Gascogne County, and you see the impact of economic pain there. And you realize that these are communities that if we can bring high paying remote jobs to them, where people can stay in the areas that they've historically lived in, and they don't have to have their kids moving out to the big cities to try to earn a living, we can revitalize a lot of these communities by bringing income and tax revenue to them.
So how can folks find you if they want to help out your campaign?
I'm on all the social media platforms at Carlen, K-A-R-L-E-N, the number 4-M-O. My website is Carlen, K-A-R-L-E-N, the number 4, Missouri, all spelt out, .com. On our website, you can volunteer and, of course, donate. We are down to less than 3 weeks before the primary, so we are trying to get a big sign campaign going. We're going to need some funding for that. We've also just signed on to, and you mentioned Spencer Toter. He's been taking a tremendous leadership role in developing a texting platform for Missouri Democrats. That is coming online this week. I just, right before I got on here, got notified that I've been activated. So I'm looking for volunteers to help me get out 20,000-30,000 texts over the next 3 weeks. And then hopefully we'll advance in the primary, and I'm going to need all of that in spades as we get ready to go up against presumably Blaine, although Blaine's got a challenge of his own with a couple credible candidates on that side. So the fall should be interesting. And if I'm part of that race come August 3rd, I would very much appreciate as much help as I can get.
Are there any upcoming events you want to highlight?
Tomorrow night, I will be at a pro-choice rally in Chesterfield, Saturday at a rally in St. Charles. Next week, I will be back out in Columbia for their county fair. I'll be in Vienna for the Democratic Party ham and bean dinner on Sunday the 24th. And also on Sunday the 24th, I'll be at a candidate meet and greet in Jefferson County. So
all over the place.
We're going to put some miles on the car this week and the week after, and try to finish this primary season as strong as we can.
All right, John. Well, I want to thank you for joining me today on the Flyover View, and best of luck out there.
Thanks so much, Kevin. Really appreciate the opportunity.
Hey there, folks. I hope you're enjoying the show. I want to remind you that we are a 100% listener-supported family of podcasts, all under the umbrella of the Heartland Pod. You can catch our flagship show, The Heartland Pod, on Mondays every week with Adam Summer, where he delivers an opening statement before being joined by Sean Diller and Rachel Parker for Talking Politics. You can also join a rotating cast of interviewers on most Tuesdays and Thursdays for Let's Have a Chat, featuring interviews with folks of interest from around the Midwest. On Wednesdays, the focus shifts to two special reports, either The Delta with Nicholas and Christina Linke, or High Country, Sean Diller's Western Political Updates. Learn more at heartlandpod.com, and don't forget, for full access to the Last Call episodes and the Heartland News blog, sign up on Patreon as a podhead today. And now, the lightning round. Gun rights group sues Colorado town over new firearm restrictions. In June, the Superior Town Board voted unanimously to pass updated regulations regarding assault weapons, the purchase and sale of firearms in the city, large capacity magazines, and trigger activators. Rocky Mountain Gun Owners, a far-right Colorado gun rights group and national gun rights organization, however, asserts what it terms standard capacity magazines and semi-automatic rifles are protected under the Second Amendment. RMGO's executive director, Tyler Rhodes, says in a statement, "Superior's anti-gun ordinance flies directly in the face of our right to keep and bear arms, and we're not going to stand idly by and let this town or any other rogue government trample our right to self-defense." A lawsuit the group filed references a decision last month from the United States Supreme Court that struck down part of New York's concealed carry law in the Supreme Court decision in New York State Rifle and Pistol Association versus Bruin. RMGO argues the court rejected a scrutiny model that has historically allowed lower courts to rule against the Second Amendment. Rhodes called that decision a wrecking ball for gun rights organizations to go after firearm regulations. Other Colorado jurisdictions recently have enacted local gun restrictions. Rhodes told Colorado Newsline that the group doesn't have any plans right now to go after other Colorado cities with restrictive firearm regulations, but the decision to do so will be based on how Superior lawsuit turns out. He called the Superior regulations the tip of the spear for this type of litigation. If a judge strikes this down in Superior, it can have implications in the whole 10th Circuit, he says. But we're starting here. Folks, this is a cautionary tale to be sure. Something to keep an eye on as groups like this see the New York concealed carry decision as open season on our safety. Criminalizing the vote. Since the 2020 election, 26 states have enacted, expanded, or increased the severity of 120 election-related criminal penalties. Of those new penalties, 102 of them, the vast majority, were enacted in just 18 Republican-controlled states. In Oklahoma, for example, voters who apply to receive a blind accessible ballot electronically but are not blind are now committing a felony. And in Texas, it's a felony for an election official to solicit the submission of a mail ballot application by a person who does not request one. In Atlanta, you could potentially get up to a year in jail for handing out snacks or water. The most commonly known type of voting laws target voter fraud, actions taken by voters like submitting false information on a registration form, voting more than once, or impersonating another voter or deceased person to cast a ballot. These type of offenses are exceedingly rare, and when they do occur, they're usually committed by voters who are misinformed, confused, or simply don't understand the law. Experts weigh in, saying that the higher penalties are unlikely to change conduct, and having more criminal laws on the books will likely not even lead to more prosecutions. Instead, even if there's no change in how many folks are being prosecuted, there will be an impact on conduct and people's willingness to fully participate in the democratic system. A federal judge dismisses Missouri Attorney General Eric Schmidt's lawsuit blaming China for COVID-19. Yeah, folks, there's nothing really to elaborate on here. I just wanted to highlight yet another loss for Eric Schmidt. Moving on. Missouri Independent profiles the top candidates for United States Senate in Missouri. Starting July 12th, the Missouri Independent, a nonpartisan nonprofit news organization covering state government, politics, and policy in Missouri, began a daily series of profiles on the top candidates vying for the United States Senate seat being vacated by Roy Blunt. The first candidate they covered was Eric Greitens, followed by Spencer Toter on the 13th and Trudy Bush Valentine just yesterday. The Greitens article highlighted a man inundated with baggage from rape allegations, campaign finance violations, and assault charges, yet still a frontrunner for the Republicans. Spencer Toter's article focuses on his advocacy and the fact that he may very well be the hardest working candidate in the race. Trudy Bush Valentine leverages name recognition, but brings little to no engagement. Keep your dial on this reporting institution as it continues to highlight candidates. 10-year-old rape victim in Ohio should have carried the baby to term, according to the General Counsel for National Right to Life, that is. Jim Bopp, an Indiana lawyer who authored the model legislation in advance of the Supreme Court's decision overturning Roe v. Wade, told Politico on Thursday that his law only provides exceptions when the pregnant person's life is in danger, saying, quote, "She would have had the baby, and as many women who have had babies as a result of rape, we would hope that she would understand the reason and ultimately the benefit of having the child." The story of the 10-year-old rape victim forced to leave her home state to terminate a pregnancy has sparked a national conversation over the consequences of the Supreme Court's decision to overturn Roe v. Wade and how far some states are willing to go to prohibit abortions. Currently, it's legal to have an abortion in Indiana, which is where she had to travel, up to 22 weeks of pregnancy. Though the state legislature is expected to hold a special session later this month to consider legislation that would ban abortion. Republican legislative leaders have not shared details of the bill they plan to introduce, though abortion rights proponents in the state are expecting the bill's text to hew closely to BOP's model legislation. Invasive worms. And no, I'm not still talking about Jim Bopp. Jumping worms, also known as Alabama jumper or Asian jumping worm, are an invasive species originally from Asia that have been popping up in states in the Midwest in the past few years. Unlike other earthworms, which are also not native to the region, these worms are not good for soil. Jumping worms have a voracious appetite, feasting on leaf litter in gardens and forests and depleting nutrients in the soil. Sometimes they can even eat the roots of the plant. The worm's excrement changes the structure of the soil to what looks like coffee grounds or taco meat, makes it hard for the soil to hold water and for plants to take root. Jumping worms are also known to push out other earthworms that are good for the soil, although it's not yet known exactly why this happens. A jumping worm can be identified by its firm skin and white band around their body, but the most noticeable characteristic is the thrashing behavior that gave it its name. Jumping worms have been in the United States for about 2 centuries now, but they only recently began to spread in the Midwest in the last 10 years, and have since been reported in nearly all states. Although these worms seem to be everywhere, there hasn't been much research about their impacts or how to manage them, leaving gardeners without much assistance when it comes to saving their plants. If someone wants to do the research, I could have many yards and ready, willing homeowners who would allow people to come to their yard and treat it or do experiments, says Jody Green, an entomologist at the University of Nebraska Extension who has been receiving calls about the worms. In Missouri, the Missouri Department of Conservation suggests helping to stop the spread by not buying jumping worms as bait for fishing, cleaning digging equipment before transporting it, and inspecting nursery plants for cocoons before planting them. And finally, a Minnesota man lights his own camper on fire and defaces his own garage in an attempt to appear targeted for being a Trump supporter. The United States Attorney's Office says Dennis Vladimirovich Mola is charged with 2 counts of wire fraud in connection with the fire that took place on September 23, 2020. Mola reported to police that someone had set his camper on fire because it had a Trump 2020 flag displayed on it, and then spray painted the Antifa symbol, Black Lives Matter, and Biden 2020 on his garage door. The U.S. Attorney's Office says Mola actually lit the fire and defaced the garage himself. Court documents show that Mola had then submitted multiple insurance claims seeking coverage for the damage to his garage, camper, vehicle, and residence caused by the fire. Mola submitted insurance claims totaling more than $300,000, receiving only $61,000 in the process. He then accused his insurance company of defrauding him. Court documents show that he also yielded more than $17,000 from 2 GoFundMe accounts. Sadly for Mola, it seems that his own form of MAGA, being to make allegations to gain awards, doesn't seem to be working out for him. His first court appearance was on Tuesday. Well, that's all the time we have this week. I want to thank you for joining us. If you feel you have a story that I should look into personally and highlight on the show, please tweet me throughout the week at KevInMidmo. Or the pod's parent account at the Heartland Pod. This week's episode featured reporting and information from CBS Minnesota, KCUR, Politico, News from the States, ABC, Kansas City Star, Colorado Newsline, New York Times, and the Missouri Independent. Thanks for listening.
The Flyover View is a production of MidMap Media, LLC. Learn more at www.heartlandpod.com or at the Heartland Pod on Twitter. See y'all next week.